Hey everybody, my name is Kate. You're on the CRN and you are listening to This Australian Life. We're filling in for Word for Word. So This Australian Life, you might be thinking to yourself, what does that even mean? What it means is that we generally talk to one LGBTIQ plus person a week and we get to hear their entire life story. First off, I just want to say though, if you're in Australia, you're listening to this, you might detect that I have a slight accent, and that accent is an American accent, not a Canadian accent, but believe me, I think it's a compliment when people think it is a Canadian accent because of the current situation that is going on right now in America. Oh my gosh. It's a lot. It is a lot that's going on. And believe me, as an American, it is difficult for me to process because I think it's not done. You know, it's still going on. And every time there's an election, I look at the map and I see how many states, I'll just say it, are red. And I go, wow, this is my country. This is the place that I came from. And it's a weird thing to think about, you know, like if I'd been born someplace else, it's entirely possible that I'd have different views, that my life would be completely different. So I don't know, maybe you can think about that today for yourself, like how lucky you are, perhaps, to be exactly where you are, to have your views, but to also know that, you know, it can be location dependent. You know, like what views do you take for granted that you have that maybe you wouldn't have if you lived someplace else? I don't know, just something to wet your whistle as we get into the episode. Hey everybody, my name is Kate and you're on Joy 94.9. You're listening to This Australian Life. Just going to apologize for the mic quality this episode. I got stuck without my mic, so I really apologize, but it's a great episode. You don't want to miss it. It's funny listening to myself back. I feel like it sounds like I'm a reporter in Afghanistan or something, but really I'm in like the bougiest place on the planet. I'm in Byron Bay in a private room in the library. So yeah, it doesn't get much better than this, but you know, it sounds like I'm really roughing it. But on to the episode. This week, I took the time to speak with Marcus. Marcus is so amazing, and he's one of the few guests on my show. Like, okay, I guess I shouldn't say few, but most of the time, I just, like, enjoy talking to somebody, and I don't really think about, you know, what's their, like, resume like. You know, I just want to hear more about what makes them tick. But with Marcus, he's actually got a very impressive record for this show. He was like world aerobics champion for 2 years and went on from there, that was like in the 80s, to instruct like the best of the best aerobics teachers because he was so innovative in how he taught and how he moved. And from there, you know, he started losing a bit of that passion. But he's also had a super fascinating life. Just the way that he was raised, like he had parents who were not at all present for him as a child. And I think that's just such a fascinating thing to look at. Like, you know, we might think of trauma and abuse as something that's so obvious, right? You can point to that thing and go, oh yeah, that person was abused. But It's the exact same thing. Not the exact same, but it can have such a powerful effect when you have people in your life who you call parents, but they're not acting that way. They're not teaching you how to be an adult in the world. They're teaching you, maybe in the case of Marcus, how to be quiet and to go inside instead of sharing who you are with the world. Although at least in Marcus's case, like, he became an amazing aerobics instructor, which, you know, is maybe more than some of us have done. So I hope you enjoy. As always, if you'd like, you can reach out to me at kate@joy.org.au.
Hello. Hey, how you doing?
Hang on. Coming. No, now I can hear you. Hey, Kate.
Hey, what's up?
What's up? It's all up.
So how about you just tell me a little bit about how you grew up?
I was born in England near Heathrow Airport, but we moved to Australia when I was about five. I was I'm an only child, so I lived kind of a very insular first part of my life. Kind of unremarkable, I think. I've said this before, and I think my parents would be insulted by it when I said my life was quite unremarkable while I was with them, but...
I think it's interesting that Marcus would say that his parents would be upset that he said that his life was so unremarkable when he was with them, when in reality, I would think Marcus would be upset by the fact that he's saying his own special existence is unremarkable. And perhaps to support this argument, the very fact that Marcus's parents are both dead maybe really just shows them as a projection for his subconscious, which is actually upset by the fact that he's saying this about himself. Sorry, that maybe that's like a huge stretch. I don't know.
There was not a lot of super highs or super lows. There's not a lot of drama in my family life. I left the drama to my own devices later on in my life. But early on, it was, you know, happy families, mum and dad, you know, me being the center of their universe.
I think this is really important because while maybe this is true, I think in a lot of ways, the stories that we can tell ourselves about our childhood, oh, it was good, oh, I was the center of their universe, can sometimes just not be true.
You know, only child, got all the attention, and that's played out interestingly in my own life. But I would say like a really genuinely happy, event-free, you know, 1 to 16 years of adolescence. But, you know, I'm finding out, you know, later on in life that a lot of that that event-free feeling of there being not a lot going on. There was a lot going on, but I just wasn't aware of it, you know, at the time. And, you know, countless decades of therapy and stuff, I'm like, oh, okay, I see what's going on there. And I see why, you know, I've turned out the way that I've turned out.
And I'm happy to say that after talking with Marcus, we definitely found some new ways that he is the way that he is.
I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't have girlfriends or boyfriends, really. I just was quite an isolated, happy kid that was quite happy to play in my room, but I'd play out in the park by myself. And I think because my parents definitely role modeled isolation in regards to they didn't really socialize.
So again, something I want you to just note as you're listening to Marcus is that we really can't trust him, no offense, Marcus, to differentiate what he felt maybe as a kid versus what the actuality of things are. Because Marcus told me later he was vice president of his class. So to say that he was not having friends, maybe that's not exactly true.
They kind of kept to themselves. So I guess I mirrored a lot of their behaviours. Yeah, so from up until I left home, it was all quite low key and low stress and low drama. And then, yeah, so 17, I left home and started to upgrade from being isolated and lonely to being the complete opposite of that.
So, like, you say, yeah, no drama, like, nothing much was going on. Like, what are you comparing that to? Like, what would you consider, like, high drama for a kid or, like, exciting for a kid?
Okay, so no yelling, no shouting, no emotion, no high emotion, no low emotion, no joy, no passion, no just flat line.
Okay, so one of the ways that drama is defined in the Oxford Dictionary is an exciting, emotional, or unexpected event or circumstance. I would argue that having parents who never show emotion about anything is pretty unexpected for the human experience.
Everything was always fine, from what I could gather on the surface. There's no friction. And subsequently, that's kind of how I exist now, in a non-friction, non-drama way, and I'm fearful of any kind of drama or any kind of friction. That's the way, that's my safety, is that, you know, it should be quiet. You know, you shouldn't have to yell, you shouldn't have to, you're never angry, you're never passionate.
And isn't that funny that somebody who is taught to never be passionate about something went on to be an aerobics instructor in the 80s and 90s, which is probably, yeah, you can guess.
Yeah, and in my other friends' lives, you know, there was brothers and sisters, there was fighting, and there was, you know, what you call divisions and interfamily struggles and deaths, and, you know, there was no death, there was no drama, there was no fights, it was just, you know, up until that point, I thought it was, like, you know, so uneventful and therefore great, because that made me, you know, not see any of those things, and therefore, if I didn't see them, then they didn't exist. But I didn't actually learn what it was like to be in any kind of turmoil or any kind of stress. And, you know, the only turmoil that I recognized was what I saw in films. I was obsessed by films and TV. I kind of lived vicariously through people in film and TV living, you know, tumultuous and dramatic lives. So I guess maybe my life was, you know, more normal than what I was considering, but possibly because I was comparing it to my portal into the, you know, Hollywood world, that maybe my life was, you know, not as dramatic as I look back and I go, God, there's really nothing, just, you know, for you to be upset about. So there's no reason for you to have had, you know, the progression that I've had.
And I think that's really important to note in Marcus, this idea that nothing really justifies how he became the way that he did. But I think sometimes, and I've heard this, I don't know anything, but I've heard that when you have trauma, you try to, or you feel like you didn't actually have that trauma. It's like an imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I guess so. And I relate a lot to what you're saying, but I would say it's like the type of drama that you had is almost like the lack of human emotion. And that doesn't make for a movie, but it makes for its own extreme version of life.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. When I first heard that concept, when a caseworker or whatever took me down that path of, like, withholding emotion, withholding love, touch, you know, I was like, oh, it was like I was being held hostage by people that would not find, what is it, couldn't find that place in them that could show those things, and therefore I never saw that or felt that. And yeah, I missed out on a large portion of what other people, and maybe because I do call things drama a lot, but maybe it's not drama. Maybe it's just like normal ranges of emotion. You know, a little bit of anger, a little bit of fear, a little bit of joy, a little bit of passion. But yeah, I was so unused to seeing or feeling that I have taken that into the rest of my life, and I am consistently cool about everything, you know.
And this is something that I love first just about doing interviews is that people really tell themselves like what they need to hear. Like that's such a magical, empowering thing. And something else that Marcus says here is he says he's consistently cool about everything. And I think that's like a big misconception, like this idea that, oh, yeah, like, oh, I'm cool with that. I'm cool with that. But the truth is like we all know. You know when someone's not cool with something. They might say they're cool. Maybe they have some body language that remotely indicates that. But everything else, like, we are so much more transparent than we think we are.
I struggle to do the highs and the lows.
Like, thinking about your parents, was there ever a moment when that sort of armor did crack? Like, do you have a memory of them ever showing a strong emotion?
I know that my mother was quite medicated. I didn't see her crack. Even when she got unwell later on in life and got very sick with cancer, she still managed to keep, you know, the pain and the emotions like under siege. Weirdly, the day I saw her cry was the day she died. So it was like, you know, I think that, you know, if I look at it from a, you know, a healing perspective, I think holding on to all that, you know, holding on, keeping a stiff upper lip and keeping that unified front of like everything's fine, even though we're not talking about the fact that, you know, we're dying of cancer, that release of like crying might have been the moment when she went, oh, thank God, you can finally let someone into what's actually happening for me.
If you're just joining us, my name is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life, where we take one LGBTIQ+ person, and you get to hear everything about their lives, at least all the good stuff, as far as I'm concerned. Also, again, just going to apologize about the quality of my mic for this episode. You know, life isn't perfect. But something that we've just heard about, which I love, is that we heard that Marcus just shared about his mom and how the one time that he saw her cry was actually the day she died. It's pretty amazing and not something that you can really make up in terms of the amazingness of life. Also, Marcus is a 2-time world aerobics champion, and he went on to have a very amazing career, which you'll hear about if you stay tuned.
That was the only time I saw my mom cry. You know, when there was an incident very early on where my mother's 2 sisters came over from England, and I'd never seen my family like all together. It was only ever my mother, my dad, and my me, and I'd never seen my dad's brothers. He's got 7 brothers. My mum had 2 sisters. I'd never seen them like coexist with family. I had this image of what it would be like, but I'd never seen it in person. And on the first day when they arrived in Australia, the 2 other sisters started to verbally fight, and then they started to have a punch up or a scratch up. Punch up.
Seriously,
punch up, scratch up. Yeah,
that's insane.
I know, right? Like happy families. I'm used to happy families, and then all of a sudden the family arrives and they have a punch up, and I'll never forget. That my mum, I felt my mum's arm come around. I think it was like 6 or 7. I remember the arm came around me, and then she just kind of escorted me out of the room. So there's like a turning of the body and the face away from the drama and then out. And I never got to see what the resolve was. So, you know, my earliest memory of drama was my mother's arm coming and turning me away and saying, "What? We don't look at that kind of thing, you know, we'll move you to another room." And then, my granddad passed away in the house that I was in. I remember my mom doing the same thing. It was like, okay, we're just going to move you out of this situation. Took me outside and left me outside by myself while they dealt with it. And then we never spoke of it ever again. So anytime there's drama now, I have this automatic response to kind of go, oh, no, don't look at that. You don't look at those things. Walk away or, you know.
It's so funny. It's like they read a parenting book and then did the exact opposite of everything every parenting book says.
I know. Yeah. But I guess, you know, they what I know of them, and this, you know, this came out much later, but I found it, they were two young, you know, cool, hip people, and they accidentally got pregnant, and then they decided, for whatever reason, to stay together because of the pregnancy. And I feel like it was at that point that some of their, you know, their inner rebel, because they were both rebels, kind of turned into, you know, conformists, you know, we're going to do the right thing. And I feel like they became, I don't know what the word is, but like, you know, parents by default.
I think this is really interesting that Marcus thinks this, that basically having the kid somehow made them these emotionalist robots. But I just don't agree. I don't think this is something that happens overnight. I think it's a lot of time and repeated behavior reinforcement that makes you, it's not just having a kid, but unfortunately that sort of story in his head probably creates a lot of issues.
And I wonder if they, I mean, I know they loved me and I know they, you know, did the best, and they did such a good job for me, apart from all the things I'm talking about, great parents, but they really didn't, it's like they, yeah, exactly, whatever manuals they got, they didn't really utilize, some of the more obvious tools of how to parent. And I use this story a lot, and this is, you know, and I don't blame my mother for this, but very early on, and I don't know if this story is true, but this is how it's kind of been, you know, it's been created through all the different times that I've told it or other people have given me intel. When I was very young, I was in the crib.
By the way, I think I should clarify, this story stars Marcus's mom, and his mom actually told him this story.
I used to cry a lot, and my mum had told me that she'd have to get up, you know, every night and, like, pacify me and, you know, as mothers should do. But she would get up, pacify me, go back to bed, get up again. And then eventually she'd get sick of getting up. So then she'd bring me in a biscuit. She'd give me a biscuit in the middle of the night. It's great for kids to see. Give you a biscuit. Here you go. Here's a biscuit. Be quiet. Here's a biscuit. Be quiet. Then she'd get sick of getting up. So then she'd grab a plate of biscuits and put the plate of biscuits next to my crib. And you'd just leave the plate there. So I would then just wake up, cry, help myself to a biscuit and go back to sleep. Whether or not that's good parenting or not, but I have had a pattern for my entire life where I will wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and go, oh, God, I've got to have something to eat. I'll go to the fridge, have something to eat and go back to sleep. So whether or not that's good parenting, I don't know. But, you know.
I think you know that's awful parenting. That's like not what you teach any kid. Like,
pacify yourself, yeah, when you're tortured with a biscuit, and don't brush your teeth.
It's the exact opposite of parenting. They didn't want to, or they weren't capable of parenting, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, if I was able to talk to them about this, and neither of them are here now, so I would be able to find all this stuff out, but all of this is just knowing the points, knowing the stories, and then trying to create a narrative around it. Because there's no other family members to even talk to this about. They're all gone. So it's
something I'll interject is that later on, Marcus realized, oh, wait, they're not all gone. And he does have an aunt who's still alive that he can ask about these things.
It's quite difficult. I feel a bit mean sometimes talking about this when there isn't, you know, actual evidence that these are true stories, but you know, sometimes when I'm trying to work out, you know, how I ended up in my certain special way, but, you know, I trace it back to, you know, evidence or stories that I've been told, and I try and, you know, work out if that's why XYZ happened.
So we'll just do the big reveal here, and it's not much of a reveal because we really don't talk about it, and I don't think it's a big part of Marcus's story at this point. But Marcus is somebody who's in recovery, who struggled with drugs, and who is somebody who is now in recovery.
Speaking about your parents, we've talked a lot about your mom, but was your dad the same way? Like, was he more shut off, less shut off than she was?
Oh, yeah, more shut off. So my mother was in comparison, she was overtly lovely and you know, connected and nice and still withholding. But in comparison to my dad, he was, yeah, he was away a lot. I don't really know where he was away, what he was away doing. I never really connected to him, to his work, something to do with telecommunications back in the old days. He was always overseas. So I never really formed a very strong bond with him. He was just the guy that was always popped back in with a present, you know, after being away for a couple of months. And, yeah, he wasn't really there a lot. So I never formed a bond with him. And weirdly, when my mum died and we were kind of forced, you know, into our first time alone together, I think I was about 40, I was like, dude, who's this guy? Like,
and maybe you're like me and hearing this information again, I'm like, Marcus, you said your life had no drama. Having a completely absent father is super dramatic.
Yeah, I didn't know how to talk to him. I had, you know, massive 4 decades of resentment that I wasn't even aware of, but I just didn't know how to communicate with him. I know he did the best for me because a lot of the moves that we the move to Australia was about, you know, giving me a better life. The move from, we lived in Mascot and then we moved out to Seven Hills out in the western suburbs. So
I'm not going to argue with Marcus here, but I'm going to argue with Marcus here. I'm going to say sometimes I think we hang on to those stories that make us feel better, but just might not be the truth. And it's like everything about his parents' behavior seems to indicate that he wasn't the center of their world, that they were living very separate existences, and maybe these moves did coincide with some sort of benefit for him, but I certainly don't see him as the center of their world.
Part of the reason why I got on my most recent path of self-discovery is because I could see that I was turning into my parents. I was turning into someone that I didn't have any friends, I didn't go out ever, I didn't call people, you know, I didn't have any connections with other humans, and that's how they both ended, with no real collaborative elements in their life with other humans.
So moving on, I'll summarize a little bit of some of the things that me and Marcus talked about. But basically, we get to the point where Marcus is in high school and he's just not digging it anymore. So he gets to year 10. At this point, Marcus is obsessed with movies because they show him drama, right? Which is like human emotion. And he's obsessed with it. Like, it's all he wants because he's just not getting it at home. So he decides to leave school and to get into the film industry.
Although I did catch up with my one and only girlfriend, and I say that in inverted commas, and she did say that the reason why I left school was because I wanted to become Steven Spielberg or a movie producer, or because I was obsessed with films and I had this idea that I was going to move to Hollywood. I don't remember any of this, but it feels right. Like, there was something about me that felt like I was destined for greater things or something embarrassing like that.
Definitely not embarrassing. And as I think I've told you, Marcus did get some greater things for sure.
You know, and I think my plan, I didn't have a plan, and that plan of not having a plan played out not for very long. I think I did straight away apply for a job at a film company in St. Leonard's and started to work as like a darkroom assistant for this kind of commercial film company. And I kind of had this idea, this trajectory, new trajectory plan where that dream of like being in the industry, the film industry was coming true. And I loved it. It was like my first foray into a 9-to-5 professional job, my first and last. And it was like the beginning of what I think was going to be my entire career was working in film and television. When I left school and I started working at that film company, I decided to join a gym and started to work on, you know, work on my physical self. And so while, you know, working in the film industry, I would sneak out
at lunchtime and do an aerobics class, and I would sneak out at 5 o'clock because it was a 5:30 class, and I'd do that class as well. And I went from, you know, fatty, and that's been calling me fatty, to being very fit very quickly, and being somewhat obsessed with how fun that industry is and was. And yeah, I quickly went from being quite unhealthy to being really, really healthy. The teachers would often say, "Oh, you're very good at this." You know, my mentor said to me one day, she said, "Oh, one day I think you're going to be doing this job." And I quickly went from being a participant to being a teacher in like the first, 6 or so months. And yeah, I don't know, I took to it really quickly. And like I said before, I've been sneaking out from work at 5. You're supposed to stay on until 8 and finish jobs, but I snuck out to go and teach classes. And one day I was teaching my class and the door opened at the front of the class, and my boss, I could see he stuck his head around the door and he kind of curled his finger at me and said, "Come on out." And yeah, he took me outside and he said, "Dude, what's going on? You should still be like editing that reel that I told you to edit."
I love this. Like, there's something about the audacity of, it's not like he just snuck out like one time. Like, I assume he's teaching like a regular class in the middle of the time when he should be working.
And, yeah, you're going to have to make a choice. It's going to be, have to do this, what you're currently doing now, or come back to work. And yeah, I just went, no, like, I'm going to choose the fun, happy, easy version, instead of the, having to stay late, work hard, and potentially have a career that could be long lasting. I chose the more fun, the more, maybe the easier route.
It kind of reminds me of that quote, like, choose a job where you never have to work a day in your life.
And so left that job and became a fitness professional. I think it was like 18 or 19. And then it quickly snowballed into, I don't know how quickly, it happened very quickly. It was like I had people behind me that could see something in me that would say, "Okay, so you're really good at this, so we're going to send you off to this place and you're going to make a guest appearance." And then that would go really well. And then that person that sent me off said, "Oh, we're going to make a T-shirt that says," they had these T-shirts saying, "Marcus is coming," which is the most bizarre statement.
Oh my God.
"Marcus is coming." So I had T-shirts around.
I mean, it's not bizarre. It's pretty overt, that one.
I know. Yeah, it was quite clever in a way. Yeah. So the "Marcus is coming" T-shirts, and there was posters all over town saying "Marcus is coming." It was quite funny, it went from being, one class in a gym to being traveling around New South Wales teaching classes, to then traveling around Australia teaching classes, and then championships. Weirdly, I don't even know how I got into that, but it was like, oh, it was suggested, you're pretty good at what you're doing, why don't you go and try it and do competitions? And I was like, "Oh, yeah, okay, I'll give it a try." And yeah, I rocked up to a competition. Everyone else had like spent months making up their routines, and I just decided to just jump up on stage and make it up as I went along. And the audacity and the balls and the kind of ego that I had back then to just go, "Oh, yeah, I can do that." And the payoff was that, I placed really well and went on to another competition and won that one. And so this weird little side job turned into...
And I think it's interesting too, like Marcus calls this audacity, and he says that the payoff is that he won. But I would say the real payoff is that he learned that you can be really brave and that like nothing bad is going to happen. Like the worst that would have happened was that he would have failed the championship or the competition.
Local to Australian to global within, the first couple of years. And I won the World Aerobic Championships a couple of times. And so something that started out as like I want to get skinny turned into a business. You know, I was like the creator of the business, and you know, the owner of the business, and I had products and CDs and DVDs, and you know, it was the strangest, most marvelous, but also the strangest segue from quite a isolated, behind the scenes, you know, quiet guy to then being like in front of people for most, you know, for most hours, for a lot of hours of every day. Long story short, the jump from one industry to another turned into, you know, 20 or 30 years of jumping around like a mad person and getting a lot of applause and getting a lot of feel-goods from a lot of people all around the world. And it was extraordinary. Yeah, it was an amazing experience.
Like, you must have changed so many people's lives, right? Like, did they say that to you?
Yeah, that was, I think that was one of the, real joys of the job, because, there's something about the exchange of energy that you get. I mean, if you look at a class and you look at someone teaching a class, it might look ridiculous in some ways, and it might look a bit, you know, a bit over the top, but there's an energy exchange that happens when you are moving and the people in front of you are moving in sync with what you're doing. That collaboration, there's a heightened, like, excitement, you know, that you get from exchanging that. So there's that. And then if you are, my job became to teach the trainers who train the teachers who teach the students. So it was like, my job was to create concepts and ideas and new things to inspire the people that are then going on to inspire their colleagues and then their students. So there's like this, in the fitness industry, there's this yearning to like learn and to gain new information, because when you've got it inside you, then you're like, oh my God, God got it. Oh, I'm so excited because I'm going to have to give that to the people that I teach to. And so there's this kind of rolling effect of what you do.
I honestly don't think that anybody would ever want to stop listening to this part of the interview. Just hands down, hearing Marcus talk about the aerobics industry, like, who thinks about that? I would never think about that. But it's fascinating to hear somebody who's an expert in what they do just talk about that.
But not only, you know, are you having tons of cash thrown at you, you're also getting people, you know, really saying, you know, this, what you are currently doing is, you know, such a profound thing for me, and they're so grateful. And dude, it makes you want to do it more, because you really get a sense of how important what you're doing is to another person, and then, you know, vicariously to all the other people that happen to get that information down the line. So yeah, it's beautiful. And you know, the counter side to that is there's a lot of pressure to be that person and to come up with those ideas, and it does take its toll, because there's a lot of responsibility to come up with the concepts and the ideas that are going to feed all those different people. But yeah, to have your job where you stand up on a giant stage and you look at thousands of people and they're all looking at you like going, okay, what's next? Like, feed it to me. And then, you know, uproariously cheering and clapping while, you know, 80s and 90s disco music is playing in the background. Pretty good job.
I mean, like you said, it's like, you have to be good at it. Like, you know, you have to want, like, not many people could do that job, you know? Like, you obviously do have the innate ability or makeup for it, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's where along the way, like, I personally cannot see the skills. I can now, but then wasn't aware of the skills that were required, because it's not something you go to university and learn. It's something that just happened during that period of time where aerobics became a thing, and then the industry of
training aerobics teachers became a thing.
And I think this is a really important point that Marcus brings up. We tend to, I think, as a society, have a bias towards school subjects. So, you know, if you got an A plus in math, that's seen as a more important skill set. Then, as Marcus noted, this idea of being an aerobics teacher, that's just as amazing as being a mathematician.
And then, that whole bubble was formed. So there was no learning curve for it. It was, so you're in the industry. Oh, you seem to be good at that, so you can now do that job. Oh, and you're good at that, so maybe you can do this job. It was, it kind of happened organically. So there was no training for it. So when the people that helped me, when I look back, those are the people that went, oh, okay, so we see the skill that you don't actually see, so we're going to nurture you and say, okay, move in this direction. And, I call them my propellers, the people that kind of propelled me forward. And they really got me to a place that I wouldn't have done myself, because I had a lot of self-doubt and a lot of old patterns of, keep yourself humble, keep yourself modest, keep yourself small, keep yourself isolated. So the industry goes, nope, keep yourself bigger, keep yourself grand, everything's bigger and bigger and bigger.
And I think this is also just super awesome to know, and just a fact of anything, like any person that you see who's famous or has done really well for themselves, I reckon they had people who supported them to get into that role. So I can't say enough for not being an asshole, or at the very least being liked and respected. Maybe I should say liked or respected.
So without those people that were recognizing those skills, I probably wouldn't have done the same trajectory that I went through. There was a core group of people that I used to travel the world with, and there wasn't a lot of us doing the job, but we sure had a lot of fun doing it.
Did you notice like a similar personality traits about you guys, you aerobic, like the ones who did really well, like were most of you introverts, or was everyone quite different?
Weirdly, the Australians, the Australians that were successful around the world were quite introverted and quite humble in comparison to a lot of the Europeans and the Americans, who seemed a bit more overtly confident and there was a realness to the Aussies, which is, I think, what the attraction was, because we were a little bit different. We were a little bit more humble and a bit more real. So they could, I got a sense when they would, we would read reviews of the Australians, they'd be like, there's something different about the Aussies. They used to call us the Wizards of Oz. And I guess the idea was that it was more relatable. It was less ego-based. It was more, we were more like technicians we were movement technicians that were doing things in a more functional and a more practical way. Where a lot of my colleagues had studied, sports science and, had degrees and things. I was just like a total fluke.
I don't know, I'm just trying to understand like where sort of your skill sets were. Like, it sounds like your real skill like was sort of your innate knowledge of the body. It was like your choreography. Would you say that's right?
Yeah. So I think my innate skill was I could... Yeah, so to impart the knowledge of choreography to another person, you need to understand that everyone learns differently. Everyone learns visually or orally or, experientially. I didn't know these concepts at the time, but for some reason, the way I would teach the choreography and create the choreography was in a way that was... a revolution in the industry, because up until that point, I think because our industry came from dance originally, so dance was the original inspirer. And when you dance, when you teach dance, you kind of do a call and response, where you just say, okay, now watch me, And then you do, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then your students just follow without there being any learning curves. So I think that was the original format of how aerobics was taught. Whereas there was a phase when I first came in where it was like, no, we can't just expect everyone to be able to learn by watching and then just mimic it. So I think what happened in my period was that it was about working out what breakdown was. It was about how to use use mathematics, numbers. You know, each move has a count and a number. There's threes, there's fives, there's sixes. It became like this kind of science. It's a mathematical equation. And so you, when you're teaching someone to move to music, which is at tempo, it's fast, you know, there's energy happening. If you're able to, it's almost like being a puppeteer. If you're able to make a person gradually move their feet in a certain way, and then you add a little, a rhythm change or an arm change, or, you know, you're gradually introducing these little steps one by one, increment at a time. Before a person knows it, they're doing a dance routine and they have no clue of how they've gotten there. So that was really the art form that I guess from my introduction to it, or to the industry, that really helped me get a name, because it meant that, because before aerobics was elitist, because it meant you had to have previous experience to come in and do a class and be good at it, because there was a notion that, you know, you just had to know how to do it, and if you didn't know how to do it, you couldn't follow. Whereas my approach was, everyone doesn't know how to do it, so I'm going to teach this from a rudimentary basic format up until the most complex, but you're going to learn every move regardless of your experience. And that was that. I guess that was my thing. It was like, don't pitch it to the top end, you know, the top 2% who are really good. Pitch it to, you know, the bottom group of people who are not as skilled, because those are the people that are going to learn and you know, become better, and that the experience is better for 100% of the people rather than just the top 2% who are, you know, choreographically adept. So yeah, it was more of turning something that was less structured and more like a dance routine into something that could be systemized, could be taught, and that kind of that filtered out through you know, through conventions, and then the conventions went to their classes, and then it became this thing like, oh my God, you can break things down and everyone can learn, and then everyone can get a, because the agenda is that everyone gets a workout. You know, the whole idea is that, right, got to lose weight, you know, got to be fit. And if people are struggling to follow, they're just frustrated, so they're not having a good time.
That's amazing. That's so cool. I, like, fully appreciate, like, because you would never get that, right? Like, you would never understand that. You'd be like, oh, yeah, he's just really good at, you know, moving around, or like, he's just really charismatic. But to know like how you revolutionized the industry like that, and like in such a kind, nice way.
I know, right? Yeah, that, and I think, yeah, when people do reflect on that, because the industry is very much about color and movement, all on the surface, you know, the way you look, the way you feel. You know, it's all very out in that field, and people do reflect back and they say, we loved that period because it was about getting to the origin of people finding their joy. And the way you find their joy and their passion is by giving them the appropriate information so they can be confident. It was, yeah, it was about 22 years of traveling the world doing that job.
Did you ever miss, like, because you were teaching teachers, it's like you weren't getting, you know, to use your terminology, like a fatty coming into class, you know?
Oh,
like,
my God, you're so right. Yeah. Yeah, you're so right. There was, yeah, it was like preaching to the converted. So the original point was to get to that portion of the clientele, but I would never see them. So it shifted, and gradually over time, I lost sight of the original mantra, which was to, you know, keep it simple and work with, you know, the new people. And because, you know, the industry kind of got me a little kind of involved in the kind of more performance based, the more let's all, you know, let's just show how fabulous we are. And I did get a bit lost, and I became one of the people that I judged in a way, and I lost some of that original kind of, I got swayed into a more, because it became quite competitive. I remember some of the conventions we'd go to, and at the end of the convention, all 20 presenters that were flown in from around the world would get, you know, trundle up on stage, and they would do like a who's the best presenter thing, and they would, you know, thousands of people there would all, you know, clap who the best presenter was. So it became less about the job that you were doing and more like a popularity contest. And that's, for me, that's where there was a shift, because I realized that this is no longer about education. It's more about, you know, whoever did the most outrageous thing on stage.
I think that's super interesting, listening to Marcus talk about this, how he sort of said, you know, he became the person that he hated in the beginning. And I think that happens to all of us to a certain degree. You know, we get good at something and we lose sight of why we did it in the first place. So I invite you, I don't know if anyone here has ever done this, but it's like you write down all the things that you want in a partner. And it's just really good because you realize, oh yeah, that's also all the things that I want in myself. So maybe trying the opposite. I think I'm going to try this after I get off here. And write down a list of all the things that you don't want in a partner. But then realize those are all the things that you don't want in yourself. And maybe you can do it for your career and stuff like that as well. Like, I'm a yoga teacher. What are all the things I don't like in a yoga teacher? And how can I just be mindful that that's a trap I can always fall into? So thank you so much for listening today. I hope you got something out of it. I know I did. And especially listening to Marcus, his bravery and his honesty, I think that's something I just, yeah, I admire so much. Have an awesome day.
Just to keep it up. upon us, you can never stop us.
Shadow of doubt survives.